chromium contamination from Pacific Gas and Electric Hinkley Compressor Station. Ms. Kiyanja.
This is our status report, and Lisa Birnbach is going to give a presentation. And then I believe it's Sullivan is going to follow her, and then Dean Webster will be the third presenter on this item.
Good evening. My name is Lisa Dernbach. I'm with the Water Board South Lake Tahoe office, and I'm a senior engineering geologist specialist, the Water Board's only certified engineering geologist. So, let's go on next page. It's been a while since we've provided you a status report. Last one was in January, so there's been a number of things that have happened, and we've talked a lot tonight about the plume and the domestic wells and in situ remediation, and so this will bring you up to date on the items that have been occurring and what things look like now. So I'm going to talk about the second quarter 2015 chromium plume map, the domestic well sampling program. I'll also talk about the status of the updated notice of applicability for in situ remediation activities. And then I'll talk about the supplemental environmental program completion, and then what board staff's next actions are planned. So we've seen different versions of the chromium plume, and actually for the last number of quarters, the plume has second quarter 2015 are those green lines, and there's one continuous plume attached to the compressor station. That's the one we call the southern plume, and then there's the middle plume in the North Hinkley Valley, and then another plume in the Harper Ryelake Valley, and those plumes are essentially been the same for several quarters now. The red line shown as first quarter 2015, that's been the only recent change. What used to be the finger in the west, we're now calling the thumb because it did get a little bigger. So, but otherwise, everything looks essentially the same as other quarters. There's been bigger changes in the domestic well sampling program. This is the program required in the 2011 cleanup and abatement order, in which PG&E is required to conduct quarterly sampling of domestic wells within the 1 mile buffer of most recent chromium plume boundary. So the plume boundary line where it's drawn does affect which domestic wells get sampled at this time until a new order is written. And based on that, PG&E needs to report the findings and then provide alternate water to affected well owners having chromium 6 drinking water maximum contaminant level of 10 parts per billion or more. So at the height of the domestic well sampling program in early 2012, PG&E was sampling nearly 300 domestic wells within the 1 mile buffer of the plume line. This map was created by PG&E from another presentation. I just kind of copied it into my program. So it's not a map I generated, but you can see in early 2012, the chromium plume was attached to the compressor station all as one plume, and this is before PG&E's increased remedial actions at the Desert Butte Dairy and Gorman Fields caused the extraction that necessarily divided the plume into northern and southern plumes. But what I really want you to notice in this map is all the dots. There are colored dots and black dots, and the colored dots represent detected chromium in domestic wells, while the black dots represent where no chromium was detected in a domestic well. And you can see that the black dots are scattered all among the color dots, and there's various reasons why chromium was not detected in various locations. Sometimes it had to do with the well being developed in bedrock or the well being developed in the lower aquifer, away from where the chromium was pulled into the lower aquifer, but in different locations. But in 2012, what this map shows is there was, can you point to the western area? The biggest concentration of domestic wells was all over that western area. And then within the chromium plume from Highway 58 North, there was still like 29 domestic wells that were being sampled by PG&E. So there was still quite a bit of concern when we issued that 2011 cleanup and abatement order for the domestic well sampling, because there was still quite a bit in the plume, and we wanted to make sure everyone was protected. So let's now go to today. This is the chromium plume map, similar to what I showed you earlier. And in this case, there are circles on the right side. Those circles with numbers in it, those represent clusters of domestic wells in certain areas. Like the bottom yellow one is 15 domestic wells, that area. And then I think, I can't read those. 16 up in the Flower Road area. And that circle on the top, that's 27. So really north of the Hinckley School is still the highest concentration of domestic wells. And a bigger difference is within the the chromium plume path, there's much less domestic wells along the path of the chromium plume than there used to be 3 years ago. So the threat or risk to domestic wells is less today than it used to be. Still, for those wells that are still there, there's some risk, of course. So just wanted to let you know that it's a completely different program. In the first quarter of this year, PG&E sampled 93 domestic wells out of about 165. And the reason some of those other wells weren't sampled, PG&E has told us some people no longer wanted their well sampled, and they stopped the program. Some people, PG&E could never find the owner to request access, and some people just wouldn't provide access at all. So there is various reasons. But at this point in time, 93 is about the current number of wells sampled. No wells that were sampled show chromium at 10 parts per billion or over. And 11 domestic wells contained chromium either at the background levels of 3.1 or 3.2 or higher. So big difference than what it was just 3 years ago. So moving on to the topic of in situ remediation, just wanted to remind you what this is about, because we've had a number of conversations this night, and then I'm going to talk about what we're doing on that topic. The in situ remediation, we have it divided into three areas, because that's where PG&E originally requested separate permits in the beginning in each of those areas, but they've now all been combined into one called in situ remediation zone, or IRZ. But they are the source area in situ, which encompasses the compressor station. Above that is the south central in situ area, which we call by the acronym SCRIA. And then the northern one is the central area in situ, and that's south of Highway 58, and that's also where another pilot test is going on that I'll talk about later. So just a summary, the in situ remediation zone is effective at reducing chromium concentrations to non-detect levels, meaning less than one part per billion, in groundwater using ethanol. Design is really the key. It requires tight spacing of the injection and extraction wells, and it requires separate wells in the shallow zone and the deep zone of the upper aquifer. Also, the type of operation affects the effectiveness of the system, whereas an active system involving both injection wells and extraction wells that kind of circulates the water through a larger area seems to spread the ethanol better and get a wider area of cleanup versus one where it's just passive, where the ethanol is just injected and relies on groundwater to carry it wherever it flows. It does require intensive maintenance, and primarily that's well rehabilitation, biofouling by biological growth in the wells is a big problem that PG&E's has had to deal with over the years. The other issue that concerns the in-situ is that it produces byproducts. When chromium is being reduced in groundwater, other metals in groundwater are also being reduced, and I'll talk about those in the next slides. And also, the system requires intensive monitoring and sampling, as well as triggers for contingency action if the byproducts move to places that wasn't expected. So let's talk about the byproducts a minute, because that's always been a lot of concern to people. What's shown in this map are the manganese byproduct plumes that were generated in the in-situ areas, and that was acknowledged when PG&E conducted the pilot test for the in-situ. It recognized that arsenic, iron, and manganese could be generated, and in fact they're all generated primarily where the ethanol is being injected. But the arsenic and iron are not shown to migrate. They just kind of sit in that area, whereas the manganese has migrated with groundwater. And we had in our prior permit that if, can you point to the contingency wells? If the manganese got to the contingency well, well, at that point there were still domestic wells close by, then PG&E had to implement a contingency plan, and that they did. So PG&E's response was to reduce the ethanol injections by half, and that's been going on for the last 4 years. So to us, this what affected the rate of cleanup. It wasn't as effective as it was before. So we'll talk about why that was needed in the updated notice of applicability. And the other issue was that to contain the manganese migration from going even further, PG&E installed two extraction wells, and can you point, down there? Thanks. Where the extracted water is piped to an infiltration gallery, and that actually reoxidizes the manganese before it goes back down to the groundwater. So these are some issues we've been dealing with the in-situ zone. And then, starting in 2003, PG&E started submitting some information to the board requesting an updated notice of applicability. And the updated notice was needed to impose the EIR monitoring and mitigation measures on the IRZ as well as the freshwater injection operations. It was needed to revise the monitoring and reporting program and also to revoke several outdated notice of applicabilities. So staff worked with PG&E, and we put together an updated notice of applicability that also included a new monitoring program. And we released that notice in July, and a comment period ended on August 17th. And we did receive comments back from the community IRP manager and PG&E, and all parties support the updated notice of applicability, but they had comments as too. So staff is currently evaluating those comments and preparing responses. But I wanted to just provide you with a little more detail about what we put in that notice of applicability. So with regards to the 2013 EIR, it described mitigation measures that would allow additional byproduct migration under certain conditions. And these conditions were that the domestic well monitoring set baseline levels of byproduct, which would require PG&E to sample domestic wells. Continued monitoring during the remediation in the buffer zone around the IRZs. Have PG&E provide replacement water if needed, if byproducts increase in the domestic wells, and restoration of the aquifer water quality baseline after completion of the project. So just because these byproducts were created doesn't mean they get to stay there upon project completion. PG&E must be must require to take actions to return them back to baseline conditions. So the updated notice of applicability now imposes these requirements, whereas the prior notice of applicabilities had not. So the updated notice of applicability. It allows additional byproduct migration distance so that PG&E can resume ethanol injections to full-scale operations. And, of course, that will affect cleanup time as well. The other task is that it will move extraction efforts at the agricultural treatment units southward, because right now those PG&E wants to use more extraction wells, and if byproducts are in that effluent water, they want to be able to distribute them to the agricultural fields. And that was described and discussed in the EIR. So we feel that all these actions would result in faster cleanup while still protecting the domestic wells, which would be monitored on a frequent basis. Let's now discuss the supplemental environmental project. This was the project that the board accepted in March 2012. PG&E started construction on it in fall. I should tell you what it was. It was to upgrade the Hinckley School water system. And in 2012, the Hinckley School was still a school operating. The original supply wells PG&E had proposed in the project were not accepted by the county because of an arsenic treatment system. So PG&E ended up installing new supply wells as well as a water line. And they were all completed in 2014. And the new supply wells meet the drinking water standards for all minerals and metals, including chromium-6, which was detected at 0.1 parts per billion. Following testing of the new water system, it was turned over to the Barstow Unified School District this year. PG&E completed the paperwork necessary with the county for the new water system. And today, the pipeline is providing water today to the school, which is being used to irrigate the fields. The project was completed 2 years ahead of schedule since the county determined that no CEQA was required for all the work. So this is the map of the upgraded water supply system. And can you show down on the bottom? This is where the two new supply wells were installed on Dixie Road. One's an active supply well, and one is the backup that the county requires for water supply. And that's the new pipeline up Dixie and Community that PG&E had to install. And it connected to an older pipeline already in place that goes up Fairview Road and goes up under the railroad tracks. And then there's one more new segment that PG&E had installed for this project, and that connected it to the school water supply. They also upgraded, I think, some valving and maybe some other things to help the school system. So everything's working well. And PG&E submitted a final SEP completion report to us in July. It shows that the costs for the project were $2.3 million, which exceeded the SEP minimum amount of $1.8 million. So it was within the requirements that were set by the board in 2012. So Water Board staff plans to prepare a SEP completion letter and issue that to PG&E. Usually we tell you, we provide you a list of some planned remedial actions, and in the past I've taken things away that were completed, but I thought maybe you'd like to see the ones that were completed, and they're shown as the red line items. So PG&E has been busy throughout this year. The first category was the agricultural treatment units, which are shown in the dark green. PG&E completed the ranch expansion area. The community east field is operating and growing wonderful grass. And then the Fairview field has been under construction, and I'm not sure if grass is starting there or not. PG&E can fill us in on that information. And the only remaining task for the agricultural fields is that PG&E is in the process of converting the what was originally the subsurface drip irrigation system. Now it's going to be an above-ground drag drip system, just like the other fields. Improvements were also made in the IRZ areas. PG&E completed installation of new ethanol injection wells, and as well as the source area expansion, extending out a few more lines. The last thing that we're waiting to hear on, it will be, take a while, in order to expand ethanol injections in this Scria middle area, where still concentrations remain in the thousands of parts per billion. PG&E is waiting for a habitat conservation plan, which has to be issued by other agencies in order to take habitat from the desert tortoise. So that's something that we'll have to wait on for the future. We talked earlier today about the lower aquifer. Can you point with that little red blob there? That's where the chromium is above background levels. And PG&E did complete installation of the new extraction well, and that is pumping. So it's not just waiting to implement that plan. That plan is being implemented already. And then the last item is the bioreactor pilot test. This is in what PG&E is proposing for maybe some alternate cleanup actions in certain areas, possibly in the future. They want to see how effective it is. It's just another kind of pump and treat above ground system. But that's a year-long project that's going to go, and then we'll get a final report in 2016. So besides the actions I've already described, the prosecution team plans to provide comments to the advisory team on the proposed cleanup and abatement order. We plan to continue attending technical working group meetings and provide input on background study and other technical matters. And we also continue to attend the community advisory meetings and keep the public informed of the chromium corrective actions. And I'll be glad to answer any questions if you have them.
Thank you, Lisa. Any questions from the board? Mr. Dice.
Lisa, I've got a question about your slide number 6.
There we are.
The two northernmost plumes are shown to be separated. Have we seen earlier maps that interpreted them to be connected?
Yes, this first quarter 2014 was the map showing them connected. And so both the 2015 quarterly maps we've received to date show them separated. And Lori did mention correctly that on Hinckley Road here, yeah, right there, yeah, there's a desert research station that has its own domestic well, as well as another group of monitoring wells by it, and those levels are below the 3.1 and 3.2 background levels.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Any questions from the audience? Okay, thank you, Lisa. Okay.
Okay, I'm Kevin Sullivan, PG&E. I'll try to eliminate the redundant items. nice figures for some of those. I want to just give you an update on remediation progress and maybe just a graphical way of sharing some of the information that that Lisa was sharing. We've gotten a lot done in 2015. I know that the focus here in the meetings has been a lot about, you know, CAO and orders, but the focus in the field has really been building out a pretty substantial remedy. I want to in the front row there, Ian Baker. You want to just wave it? Ian's the guy on our team who there's a lot to do on this project, and if it involves getting chromium out of the ground, that's Ian's in charge of that aspect. So he's had a busy 2015. So a couple of the things just to call your eye to. Most of the work has happened in the yellow boxes. We expanded this ranch agricultural unit. If you're driving on the old Highway 58, you see that one off to the right. There's a like a GPS-controlled kind of pivot arm. It actually wiggles in and wiggles out to avoid some of the tortoise habitat in the area. We've made a lot of agricultural engineers really happy because they get to ply their trade and do things that most normal farmers don't need them to do. We're showing here in Hatch the new intended outline of the Desert View Dairy. For those of you who have been out there, you know, the Desert View Dairy has really been sort of the workhorse. It was the system that for a long time was the only operating system from about 2004 to about 2007. It's the one with the tubes underground. It's showing its age. You know, the farmer hasn't been able to plow that field since, you know, 2004, so they're getting a lot of, you know, a lot of weeds and things like that. The crop's not as good and healthy. So we want to replace that with these circular pivots and change the geometry around. So that that's one of the last pieces that's underway. Down here in the source area, this is the area that we really wanted to attack strongly. This is, as we focus in the next couple of years on really getting the mass of chromium out, this is where most of it's going to come from. We're just starting to get kind of initial pumping data in, but the concentrations down here are on the order of 100 to 1,000 times higher than they are in places up here, depending on exactly which wells you compare. So if you get a gallon of water out here, you're going to get 100 times as much chrome out down here as you are up here. So bringing these on is really going to help. As Lisa pointed out, we call this the community ag unit. That is up and running. If you have time tomorrow before your meetings or on your way out of town, I'd encourage you to, if you haven't been out to Hinckley recently, it's worth a look. I would suggest the feel of the area is changing because there's a huge overpass now between here on Linwood Road, between here. If you drive across the freeway over Linwood Road, there's now a brand new overpass over the railroad and 66. We understand that Caltrans put that in, anticipating heavier truck traffic off the new 58, that you'll be able to turn off of 58 on Linwood Road and basically come right to this, you know, this area, and they think that may get a lot of traffic. So if you go out there, you'll then find that Linwood Road is cut off. The new Highway 58 cuts right through the middle of the plume, and they're into grading out there. There's now only one way from, like, if you want to go from the station up to the there, you have to drive up, go over to Dixie Road, cross, and then back. So all these other roads are cut off. So it's helpful, I think, to go see it because it starts to give a feel of what Hinckley's going to look like over the next few years. And I think it's going to feel very different with that, you know, with a highway kind of, you know, bisecting the area. If you'd go out, drive down Community Boulevard, when you see the big yellow station on the left, look to your right. There's a field that this morning was halfway cut. And there was, like, literally, you know, fresh hay in the front and 6 foot tall, you know, grass in the back. So that crop's coming in really well. We have one farmer partner, Paul Reichen, who ran the Desert View Dairy, who's farming this. This down here is part of kind of an offset farm swap that we'll talk more about some other time. And we're partnering with Kenny Harmson, who runs the Harmson Dairy over here. So all this is getting grown by, you know, by local farmers, and all the feed is feeding local cows. So it all stays right here in the Hinckley Valley. This unit, we're in construction this morning. Ian, I think those were, I think I saw large piles of manure. I haven't spoken to you, but they're the field prep is underway. So if you go out tomorrow, you can see that. And then a little closer, and it's a little hard to see, the blue dots are groundwater extraction wells, and there's a whole series of them because in this area, in the layers where the chromium is, there's not big high producing wells. So we put a lot of little ones in. They pump smaller, but in aggregate, we're going to get a lot of water out of there. And again, if you're driving down Community Boulevard, you can look to the right. You'll see a bunch of things with antennas and little, they look like little spikes coming out of the top. Those are all tied into our telemetry system, so they can be controlled. And then the other big part, which is actually going to do more remediation in the area than the extraction, are these yellow dots, which are the new IRZ extraction wells where new ethanol will be coming in. So this is the before and after on that ag pivot. This picture is from about 4 weeks ago. Like I say, now the crop's about 6 feet high. This is the before, you know, we turned it on, and now, you know, with the application of water. You know, within the last 12 months, we brought on about another 84 acres of agricultural treatment. A lot more wells are going in. In fact, there's drill crews are still out there. The bulk of the remediation wells are doing. Right now, there's some drilling going on in support of the USGS study. There's some background wells and samples being taken at the direction of the U.S. Geological Survey. But a lot of drilling has happened this year. You know, and then overall, by our count, we've had over 20 different remedial construction or system improvement projects. Now, some of those were brand new projects that we needed Water Board, you know, permitting for. Other of these were sort of operational type of things. We used to have several different control systems for each one of these things, sort of got built one at a time. There's now a site-wide integrated control system, and that sounds sort of, you know, dull and boring, but it really lets us run the whole system more effectively and more efficiently. We've put in close to 3 miles of pipelines, both for the SEP project as well as, you know, all these little dots have to connect to all those green squares, and all those green squares have to connect. So there's a lot of pipe that's gone into the ground. We've put in 45 new remedial and monitoring wells. You know, altogether, you know, we spent 40,000 man hours this year on these construction and optimization projects. So it's been a really sizable effort that we're largely through. You know, I think by the end of first quarter we'll be pretty well done. And you know, there's a lot of different ways to measure efficiency. One of the things we keep our eye on is, we want to get the chrome out. We want to use the water wisely. Those are sometimes in tension, right? Because there's a just pump more water, and it's like, well, we are in a drought, you know. So we talk a little bit about efficiency, and obviously, if we can get more mass per gallon out, you know, that seems like a win-win. So we're up about 18% in the first half of 2015. And again, these things are challenging to measure, but we're clearly on a good trend there. Lisa, I think, showed almost this figure exactly on the SEP. Like I said, that was completed. It's a good long-term reliable source. You know, part of this was the more we looked at the area around the station, there's a fault there, there's nitrate impacts from adjacent farmers, there's obviously the chromium plume. This just seemed like a much better, longer, more reliable spot. And as Lisa pointed out, there's two wells there, there's one in a backup. And so this trunk line is, you know, there's a lot of infrastructure. It's a pretty valuable piece of infrastructure that's now in that can supply water. I wanted to just talk a little bit about this. You know, we've been looking at, as I'm sure a lot of folks here are, you know, we've been looking at a lot of graphics and figures about the drought. And I wanted to just sort of put an idea out for you, because I know we all talk to other folks about what's happening at Hinckley. And you know, I'd like to suggest, as I listen to the discussions that are going on in the Central Valley, you're going to have briefings tomorrow on Sigma and, you know, what's coming. I think through what might be a fortunate, you know, coincidence of forces, I think if you want to look at the future of California agriculture, you can look right here in Hinckley. Because I think it is one of the only places in the state where you really have a thoughtful, scientifically based review of both groundwater quantity, and that's because of the adjudication. You know, that was the basin was adjudicated a long time ago, so you have to think about how much water you're pumping, unlike, you know, what's going on in a lot of other places right now. But then also, because of the work that's been done here, because of the EIR and the work, you know, we've actually put some thought to what are the impacts of agriculture on long-term water quality. You know, and that is, you know, from my view, just sort of conveniently forgotten in a lot of the debates around. But here, you know, we've really kind of looked at that and tried to grapple with it. And I think, you know, you see that. This is a graphic out of the New York Times, and it just really struck me that, you know, red is bad. It's how much the wells are dropping. The bigger the circle, the more the drop, you know. And lo and behold, you look at the valley, and I know I have a lot of my friends who know the work I do saying, oh, is this drought killing you, you know, down in the Mojave Valley? And the real answer is no, because we've had a good groundwater management system in place for a long time, and we work within that system. We buy water rights and figure it out, and, you know, lo and behold, there's some red, but there's small red circles, and there's, lo and behold, there's a lot of blue circles in the area, which, you know, says maybe the water master's doing their job, you know. So I think between that and now, you know, the thoughtful byproduct monitoring, you know, I think if you want to imagine, you know, if you want to look into the future, I think 20 years from now, something a lot like this program that we've sort of, you know, come to by, you know, without maybe organized thought, but between the Water Master's work and now the work that's been done, you know, by you folks and by, you know, the EIR, I think this is what you're going to really have to do if you want sustainable, you know, agriculture. You know, you see other stuff. We use really efficient irrigation techniques. We cut, for a given amount of crop, we use about 15% to 20% less water. We've had a lot of interest from other farmers coming in to see that. The other thing that I think gets lost in the shuffle is that this farming, we've removed hundreds of pounds of chrome. We've removed hundreds of tons of nitrate, you know. And again, you know, the nitrate comes at usually in the milligrams per liter. You know, chromium generally is in the micrograms per liter. So we've gotten an awful lot of nitrate out of there, and that nitrate, you know, cuts fertilizer use, and it's also, you know, it's a good sustainable, you know, closed loop. And then, as I said before, you know, we kind of partner with the local farmers. So all that is staying here. On the upcoming activities, the DVD pivots. This is a picture of the bioreactor test. One way to think of this is like a shorthand that I've used. It's almost in situ in a box. So the same kind of biogeochemistry where we add ethanol and we get some bacteria to grow, and that breaks down the chromium or changes the chromium from chrome 6 to chrome 3. It's that same chemistry, but we're putting it in a box so we can control it. And, you know, we can put dirty water in and clean water out. Now, these units we're testing to see how much they treat, but there's a person standing on top for scale. These units are going to treat somewhere between 5 and 10 gallons a minute, okay? Whereas one of those pivots treats on the order of 125 gallons, or, you know, on a yearly average. So you'd need a lot of these boxes. Okay, so I just, you know, we think it's a good technology thing. We think it's going to have its niche, but we're not going to just throw away all the ag units and replace them with, you know, bioreactors without a very good reason. And then, you know, the other thing, we've done a lot of work, which, again, I think is, we haven't spoken a lot about here, but getting these bio permits, defining areas of habitat for Mojave ground squirrel, desert tortoise, and then starting to come up with conservation plans and habitat management plans has been a pretty significant undertaking by our team as well. So that's all that I have, just to try to give you a flavor of what we've been up to besides commenting on draft orders. You know, happy to take any questions.
Any questions from the board? Mr.
Dias. Kevin, if the bioreactor pilot test is successful, will you expand the scale of operation?
Yeah. So we could. In my mind, the bioreactors are sort of similar to the agricultural treatment. In the ground, they more or less serve the same function. You pump dirty water up, you make it clean in the farming, or you make it clean in the bioreactor. Now, the difference is that with the bioreactor, we could then have clean water that we perhaps could inject, right? So there might be some opportunities, you know, there for enhancement. The other thing that we think about, you know, as we're in discussion with the community, it also now gives us a clean water source that we could perhaps do something else with. We could sprinkle a soccer field or, you know, water a putting green or, you know, you could do other things other than agriculture, you know, with that water. So it's very much a developmental technology, but we think it's one that has promise and, you know, in a year we'll know if we have another tool and then we can start to say, great, we have this, what could we do with it? But we don't have concrete plans to, you know, put one here or there or anything like that, because I think we generally feel that the hydraulic control and mass removal we're getting with the ag coupled with the in situ, we think that's a good mix right now, but this may give us some other options to imagine in a year.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Any questions from the audience? Okay, thank you. Next, we have the IRP manager, Mr. Webster.
My control number from here.
It's a light on.
Lights on. Fun.
Okay.
Good. Good evening.
Louder.
Good evening, board. Ian Webster, IRP manager. Thanks again for being invited to make a few remarks at this meeting. My goal always is to try and represent and give you a perspective of the community's interest in the project, the work that the IRP manager has been doing under the mission that we've got to basically communicate and be a kind of a technical resource to the community to understand what's going on in a very complicated project. So I've got about 12 or so slides that are in your book. Made no changes to them since I first formulated them perhaps 2 or 3 weeks ago. A lot of them are pictorial. Feel free to ask questions. I'm also ably assisted in my IRP manager work by Drs. Halil Kavak and Miguel Sanchez, who are sitting here and whose names are on the front cover. By the way, this is actually a photograph I took of the community East Ag Treatment Unit a couple of weeks ago, and you can see the height of the growth there. It is worth going out and seeing, as Kevin said. So where's the community's focus? You know, this information I'm going to talk to you is a result of our almost weekly meetings with the core group, as well as you'll see later on discussions in much larger forums, breakfasts, etc. that we've conducted to try and solicit input. Pretty much a two-way street. I'll talk a little bit later on how I think somehow the community attitude towards the overall project, engaging progress, I think is changing. When I was first introduced, probably the right word, to this project, maybe 4 years ago, the questioning was tough and there was a lot of suspicion around technical information, what is PG&E doing, the meetings we used to hold over at the old school gymnasium, they were tough going. I think the attitude of a remedy being in place, concentrations declining, Highway 58 going on, a change in the demographics in Hinckley, all point to the fact that there is a future here. It'd be different than it was in the past, but I think with this, as Peter Pumphrey has said, the goal I think through time is to basically transform Hinckley from a place that had a plume and is unfortunately recognised as having a plume into one having a future that is not a plume. So what the community's eyeball on is basically this background study. You've heard about it thematically throughout the meeting today. It's a very important point in the years ahead of defining a number that eventually will be a performance or a cleanup goal for the project. The community has been interested in speed to completion. The cleanup and abatement order, draft cleanup and abatement order, has got time frames in it. The community's been very interested as to how these particular time frames, 90% within the 50 PBB. How was that established? In fact, that took us back into what is modelling? How do you, it's not people's photographs and magazines, it is actually doing computations using computer models. What is that? How does that work? Spend a lot of time on that. The understanding the fact that the plume is definitely kind of a sliding slope of high concentrations from the compressor station head north, and if you go after the core of the plume, you're really removing mass, as Kevin just said. You really are cutting the head off of the snake, as I've described it. And then I'll talk about some of the technical questions that come to IRP Manager, and then of course the ever-present one that's the soft issue, which is the above ground issues. I think in the past I've talked to you about, it took me years personally to get to this point where my mission and my writ is technical communication, but people are really concerned about the soft issues and the above ground issues. So the below ground, I think as Amy Horn said, we can't see 80 feet underground, but folks can see the surface. And a lot of the questions that come to the IRP manager is how is the remedy in the grand scheme going to affect the surface of Hinkley in the long term? So, as the IRP manager, we're active in submitting comments to the water board, as the folks here know, and hopefully they've been positive and contributory. I think one that was highlighted today was the introduction of a decision tree, a logic tree, into the new order. I think that's always a positive thing. It basically codifies that the verbs and sentences are good. When you have a decision tree, it really helps. We publicize or we write with very much community input now a quarterly newsletter that basically highlights both hard tech issues as well as soft issues related to how the plume in general and its cleanup can affect the long-term interests of the community. And again, the language in this, we pore over it on Thursday nights in the IRP manager's office. There's some key members are instrumental in writing some of the language in this document. And it goes, as I say, to about 300 folks in the Hinkley community. Part of the feedback that I've received as the IRP manager is in these grand meetings where we give 25 long slide presentations with technical data, that's great. I just want to talk. And I think, as an engineer, I'm used to giving presentations. And I think it's the be-all and end-all of communicating. But it's not. It's more the bedside manner of sitting with folks and talking to them in a free-flowing manner. So myself and staff, Drs. Kavak and Rogel Sanchez, have visited about 50 home visits. Think of almost like home doctor's visits, although in Chrome 6 issues, since 2012. And we intend to try and wrap that up. One of the missions, I think, if the IRP manager function is continued under the new order, is to basically get more of this bedside manner operational. It works far better than grand presentations. What this leads to, and it's pretty obvious, many of these things I tell you are obvious when you see them on a slide, but looking ahead, they're hard to actually see in your optics. This community is very diverse, and people have got very different interests, and I think I've described it somewhat, even though I've been talking technical issues, it's the old classic picture of the elephant. People touching the elephant at different points, and they have different feelings about what the animal they're touching is. People touch this project and come away with different impressions of what it's all about. And some of the key stakeholder groups that we've talked to are listed here. For example, Penny Harper, who is here this afternoon, sat right in the front, has been a very active participant, and she's got kind of a group of like 10 or 15 folks in the north that she learns stuff about and takes the information back to the far north area. So she's interested, obviously, in this amorphous kind of finger of the plume that is heading north, whereas folks more further down to the south near the core are interested in topics like IRZ, byproducts, etc. Is the box working, etc. I also mentioned here the community centre group. That is one. There's 50 to 75 people listed there. A gentleman called John Turner has been very instrumental in bringing folks together in a very collegial manner to understand and discuss the project. The community centre has got maps on the wall now about what the future of Hinkley could be. People pin little things on ideas. And it's a way of getting information back into us that we can put back into the grander project. The community does realise that there is progress in a remedy. I mean, there's been a morass, as I think Kim pointed out, EIR, now the CAO debate, massive paperwork, etc. But if you actually, as Kevin reflected, in the field, there is pipes going in, there's grass growing, there is GPS systems working, there is ethanol being injected, etc. That is completely forgotten somewhat as we deal with the paperwork. And so I have continuously talked with the community with the fact that while the paperwork does go on, there is remedy construction being put into place. So the shape of the systems that you see right now, Kevin mentioned first quarter of 2016, the framework of the infrastructure that will pump and treat water and basically bring this plume back in is basically been put into place right now. It's a question of operating the animal. With the key point of, like, with adaptive management principles in place. I may come to that in a minute. In fact, this is where perhaps I mentioned adaptive management. So at the last meeting we had across the street over here, and this dawned on me, one person said, you know, I would like to congratulate the water board. When you sit down with a blank sheet of paper and try and write what you've had to codify into an order that will last decades, that will be a roadmap. I was thinking this afternoon as we were sitting here, I'll be long gone. I'm not sure where it'll be, but I'll be long gone. And someone's going to be looking at this document, teasing through it, looking for guidance on how to basically manage and regulate this plume and work with people at PG&E 15, 20 years from now. So it's really important the document is written broad enough, but specific enough. And I think all these tools that have been brought in, such as the decision tree, and again, this adaptive management approach, which means basically when new data comes in, there's a management philosophy that systems can be changed to adapt and clean up faster. That culture and attitude that should be inherent in that order is extremely important. And we've tried to talk about that with the community. And also the community members have actually given feedback to me that the water board's work in writing from a blank sheet of paper has been tremendous. So we stand. I congratulate you on describing that document. Enough said here. This was, you know, we participated, the IRP manager actively participated in the workshop that you had. And again, our big things are the blend of prescriptiveness, performance-based, and adaptive management. These are the three kind of points in the triangle that will make this thing work going ahead. Into the softer stuff, I'll speed up here, but I mean, into the soft stuff, it's part of the engine room that keeps the project going along. There's no project that I think I'm involved in. I'm involved in quite a few that have been conducted. Engineering and data gathering has been conducted with such transparency and openness. It is quite remarkable, this project. We continue to host meetings, breakfast, lunches that people can talk at. By the way, this little small gentleman here in the center is my son, who basically has obviously got his own opinions about Form 6 remediation, and he's talking there. But I'm bringing him up here to say, you know, this is a project that Dad works in. It's very interesting stuff. And then on the PG&E front, PG&E also has gone out their way to basically bring folks into the guts of the system that they're working on. This, for example, this is Ian, who's sitting in the front there, conducting a tour in June for key community members who expressed a great interest, especially, for example, in the bioreactor system that Kevin talked about. So again, open understanding of pulling back the shade from the data and how Chrome 6 is treated. There's no question this job is very, very different than it was in 4 or 5 years ago. The issue does remain. I think this big thing about Dr. Risbicki's background number, the drawing of the plume that we all went to this afternoon, and I'll leave it at that. But I do want to drive home this particular point as the IRP manager. I've used this slide before. I'm going to continue to use it because I think it reminds us of the impact of a remedy 80 feet underground has had in the Hinkley community that obviously affects people's thinking about how they view the project. So we focus constantly on the below ground topics. Most notably today, we're still focusing on what's the shape of this plume. But all these other topics here are things that have been in play and the IRP manager has talked about a lot. And that basically was where my own personal function was to explain these components to interested community folks. But as the job has moved along, progress can be viewed very differently when you sit not 80 feet underground, but you sit on the surface. Now, since I think the slide was kind of concocted and put together perhaps even a year ago, a lot of effort has been put into this surface type stuff. And in fact, there's the kind of fledgling effort among certain folks, and I won't name them here, but there's an idea of basically addressing this topic, these above-ground topics. As this work continues over the next 25 to 30 years, how is this improved on the surface here? That you cannot decouple these two topics. So where I would like to take the outreach, and this slide actually I think is in comments that we submitted to the Water Board regarding the future of the IRP manager. I know it's been codified, the function in the CEO draft. We'd be happy to continue the role, but whoever continues in this role in the future, you know, I think the vision should be a lot of this bedside manner. I think that the big presentations, the days of that are few and far between. If there are large gatherings, they should be done with a workstation approach where there's kind of easels around the room and people can pick and choose what topics they want to, because they might begin the inherent diversity in the community. The other thing I think is clear is that the use of visuals and actually tabletop models, they have been like a magnet in terms of explaining stuff. When you've got a model on the tabletop and you can talk and point to it, people understand far better than perhaps just flapping your arms or even showing slides. This background study, there's no, like from the lay person's perspective looking at the project, there's an extreme interest in what Dr. Izbicki is doing. It's extremely complicated work that he is undertaking from a scientific perspective. A little anecdote, as I met about 2 weeks ago, Dr. Izbicki was, 2 weeks ago, he came up to the, he was in town, and he was just in town when we were about to start our IRP manager meeting on a Thursday night at 6 o'clock. So I said, why don't you stay for a few minutes, and say a few words about what's going on. 1 hour and a half later, Dr. Izbicki was talking as though from a textbook, never broke stride, never repeated one sentence, and people's jaws were agag, I mean, basically. But that's the he talks at an incredibly complicated level, trying to distill it down. So one of the bridges, I think, with the IRP manager's function's got to be, again, from this ombudsman perspective, is taking Dr. Izbicki's work and being a separate voice and communicating it to the community. Enough said. In fact, and here is, as the background study goes on, there are numerous independent meetings with Dr. Izbicki as he leads this rather expensive understanding. As Kevin said, there's probably no water in the state of California that's been well studied as Hinckley groundwater, and a lot more to come in the next 3 years with Dr. Izbicki. And so the takeaways from my remarks just now are outreach has got to be maintained, I believe, personally, at an appropriate level. Bedside manner, not large talks. There's a lot of interest on people do realize very clearly that the documentation in place right now, this draft CAO, is a blueprint for this project in terms of enforcement, compliance for the next 25 to 30 years. And writing a document like that is extremely difficult to do. I mean, none of us could write something right now that we believe would be a recipe that would sustain for 25 years in the form of kitchens. And that's the challenge in place. They focus on what's a natural thing to think about. Of course you focus on what's important to yourself, but the communication approach in the past has been, we're trying to tell you what's important and you should learn this. Doesn't work. And then, the US background study, and especially this other one, ground floor water modeling, where has the water gone? In fact, you know, Darren Banks referred to 1 to 3 feet per year. That's the tip of the iceberg in modeling. It's a very sophisticated models, particle tracking, finite element modeling to try and figure out how water flows 80 to 100 feet down through the Hinckley Valley. So that's my remarks. A little bit of technical, a little flavor of the outreach and the number of meetings we've had. In fact, we had a breakfast last Saturday morning. Others, it's not shown in these slides, where 50 people attended. But the same idea of basically using food combined with posters really does help get the information flow through. So thank you for your attention. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dr. Webster. Any questions for Dr. Webster?
Dr. Webster, I have a question on slide number 6.
You seem to like that number.
Can you read for me the text in that top black box?
This says Penny Harper, who is a resident, long-term resident up there, group 10 people. What I've done here is basically there's various kind of local area hotspots of not in the environmental sense, but in terms of folks of cores of interest in the project. And Penny Harper's been a long-term resident. She, in fact, was one of the first CAC members 3-4 years ago. And so she's now rejoined the kind of reformed community advisory committee, and what she learns, she takes back to the far north.
Was Harper Lake named after her family?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
Penny was a nurse that grew up in Santa Monica and has retired out here probably 12, 13 years ago. I haven't even thought that way. But
just a coincidence.
I don't believe so.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
I have a question. So we do usually still get communications from citizen groups that I don't think are reflected in here, and there's some concerns that are expressed about the background study and uranium and some other issues. Have you worked on reaching out to those groups, or are they not interested in?
Well, we don't know what comes into you, but when we have an 800 number. We have people call that number because we used to kind of some folks too that if there's a perennial issue, we'll literally start copying material. We've got the website too, but that's pretty clear. That's not a way of getting information out in the Hinkley community. All these slides that we've got, if they've got access to the web, everything we've got is on the website. It's very well kind of on the different buttons. If they're asking specific questions, we call them. Riddell and Halil have made numerous trips. They're up here every week on Thursday and make field trips. This map, in fact, requires to be updated. You know, for example, the folks living way out here only recently appeared, maybe 4 or 5 months ago at a meeting, and we actually came out to them and talked. And they have some issues that are not plume-related, and we get many strange questions that come in, but we try and handle them as well within our writ as the IRP manager, and we've been pretty clear about it. We think we can offer you commentary on that, or that really is you should talk to somebody else in the city of Marshall or whatever. So we've been very responsive. In fact, we've got a metric to try and keep of responding to all calls within 48 hours of coming in.
How are the three, you mentioned 300 people received the newsletter. So are these people who had signed up for the newsletter, or do you just mass mail it to every address?
Yeah. And it's obviously we've had a trouble, you know, not so much now because it's leveled out, but in the past 2 years as people have left town, we got quite a few return to the office. So we've tried to adjust our mailing list. I don't think we've quite, the newsletter is effective, but I've got my own. I'm debating with staff about to try and make it more even vivid, or even links to can you find some video if you click here, etc. And again, the big thing has been the community folks being interested in writing sections for it to actually put into it. Definitely encourage that. And the backside of it is also in Spanish too, so
okay.
Yeah, bilingual.
Dr. Webster, I think the role that you play as kind of the bridge to the community has been very important in this process. Over the last few years, what's the difference in population that you see in the community? I've heard it's just been decimated with all the people moving out. Can you quantify the reduction in population?
I would say, Dale, you can probably help, but we're probably down from 800 people down to potentially 300. 800. The number of homes, we got about we probably got about, say, 1,000 people max back, or even 1,200. And we're definitely down less than 500 people, no question about it. Of which there's probably about 150, I've got a pretty good eyeball. If you said to them, what do you know about Kinkley? You know, as a group of plumes, where is roughly the cumulative process that's going on? They'd be able to answer 6 out of 10 questions pretty intelligently. And of course, within that, there's a much smaller core of perhaps 25 to 30 people who really, you know, have been thematically on this. Now, every meeting we have, they're there. So it's stabilized.
Any questions from the audience? Yes, sir.
Hi, my name is Larry Greek, and I've been on the CAP. The last 3 months or so, I've worked over at the fire barn, handing out food to the Hinckley residents. It's a very tiresome job to go get tons and spend 14, 15 hours picking it up, bringing it back. Then you got to bag it all up and everything for a whole day. So then we gave it out last night. Probably about, I think, about 80-some people picked up food. Now, a lot of them were to the west. These people all have issues with the water board. They don't trust them. They don't trust PG&E because they're kind of like left out. You know, the water board has conveniently allowed PG&E to have a board. If you're west of the plume, it's like you're not in the community. And that is not right. You people draw tax money from the whole state. You draw tax money from the whole community of Hinckley. The community at Hinckley at one time went all the way to Boron, and it went all the way over to the railroad tracks. It shrunk up. But this water, through the years, 50-some years of their polluting it, during the high table, low table, whatever you want to say, that high concentrations of hundreds of thousands of gallons of chrome 6, probably millions of them, truths known. You got to understand that that water would have traveled in every nook and cranny throughout the whole area. But the thing is, when water goes out and it comes back, the table here, because it goes fast and drops a little, then when it comes back and this water comes back to the gap, it leaves deposits, all these little pools, puddles, where some people are in a good water table, suddenly now their water table is lined with chrome 6 through all these years it's there. Well, then later on, you know, you have disturbances or stuff like that. The chrome 6 is like the adhere in the water and it flows on. And it's just like the plume area. Now, they probably dumped 250,000 tons of chrome 6. I could be corrected. You water board people should know. Okay? Now, they claim they cleaned up about 107 tons. Where's the other 140,000 tons? Where is it?
Is that a question?
How deep do you think that this chrome 6 is on the bottom of the plume and in all areas waiting to be picked up? There should be core samples all the way to the granite, all over, just not pick and choose, all over. PG&E should be testing. You should test all the way to the west to the farthest area where there's some chrome. There's an area about 3 miles to the west of the plume of this bar. Some of the people in there got a close to 3, I think, chrome 6. Dr. Izbecki, when I first got on the CAP board and he first come aboard, I had issues with this. And he said verbatim, and you can check this, the chrome 6 in the Hinckley area to the west was about 1.3 maybe max. Not very much, and just very few deposits. This valley, he said, wasn't really consistent in this area of having chrome 6. But, you know what I mean, influence can change it. But that was said for probably a year. My first 2 years, I listened to him tell us how the plume hadn't moved. Nothing was happening. And then I said, well, listen, we need to start testing and all this. That can't be true. Now, water moving, it's got to pick it up. Okay, so we started testing. Guess what? Suddenly, miraculously, the plume moved. And then all the trouble. I'm in an area across from the CAT committee. I ended up, last couple years, I got real high concentrations of arsenic. The manganese is probably 20-some, but the arsenic is 20-some. You know, it's not good for you. And I've told employed the water board. She says I'm on the south side of the fault line, and to the west of the fault line doesn't apply to me. You know, same way with Kevin. I think Kevin and I, we clashed it numerous times. All over these issues, you know. Oh, well, on deaf ears. Oh, you're on the other side of the fault line. It's just like there's a big block there, you know. It comes here and stops. Okay? The thing is, which is not so, my property, the fault line is on the northwest corner of my property. I got 5 acres on the other side of it. I got a well 200, 300, 400, 500 feet to the north of it. But still, when you got a fault, Dr. Becky said the water will travel maybe along it or something. So you're doing all this pumping and all this injecting and all this stuff they're doing. They were dumping stuff in a well to the south of me, bags and bags. It would back up and make my water white. I mentioned a few times, they never stopped. But then they said, nothing travels back. Yes, it does. Throw some dye in a river and see if it just all goes this way, or maybe if it kind of backs up a little bit and you throw it in there. So contaminants go all over.
Well, I think you bring up a good point that continued sampling is definitely necessary in this area. Did you have a question for Dr.
Yes.
Webster before I let him sit down?
Yes, we've got a lot of things.
All right, you can
I have one there as far as the concern of the people. I would say, in reality, there's probably, what, a couple thousand people left in the whole Hinckley Valley. I mean, not just the plume area where you seem to stick to. I mean the whole community area. This is to the west. You know, you got to understand, Ian, it's to the west of the plume, not just the plume. You need to reach out to them people. Now, I talked to about 80-some people. A lot of them lived over that way. I haven't heard one of them that's seen you guys in that area.
No, we haven't. I mean, full disclosure, I mean, you can see there's been a greater locus of people to talk to, I mean, to the west. There's quite a few folks over here, but generally people have been interested in this. A lot of this communication over here, as you know, Larry, was because of concerns about our secondary products, arsenic and manganese, making a left turn and leaving the reactor box. So a lot of people here were interested in that particular topic, including yourself. I think that, you know, you raised a lot of topics just now. I know that you're always interested in these topics, and there's kind of a smorgasbord there of issues.
Yeah.
But to try and highlight them again quickly, I think it is pretty clear and is, would agree in this, is that the plume basically is moving like this. The idea of lateral movement, the modeling shows it, the groundwater elevation data that's been collected through hundreds of monitoring well points, we clearly indicate a general trend basically south to north. And you can see it from the signature of the plume. This is your core right here. There's been a lot of talk today, earlier on, in other parts of the meeting about this plume. On the wall here, at one point, when I joined the job, was drawn completely contiguously. But because of various pumping efforts, national attenuation to, it's broken into a couple of islands here. I bet if we're back here in 5 years from now, this core's going to look a lot smaller down here. And as to how we're plotting these, well, it'll be codified by the orders, but, you know, there are islands out here. What else did you bring up? I think the reversal of groundwater flow, that groundwater can basically move backwards on a net basis, is probably unfounded. If you get a slope like this with a glass plate and I pour water on it, the water's going to go downhill. It's not going to come back up the glass plate. That's what you're really kind of dealing with here. It's like water falling on the windshield of your car. It's going to fall down the windshield as opposed to come back up it.
Here's the thing. When you have high range and you have flood areas and stuff, you're wrong. Your flood waters will go as far as they can. They raise as high as they can. Say they come to an end. When water hits an end going at a speed, what does it do? It comes back. Or you have special water and it doesn't move back.
Perhaps that's a conversation you could have with the good doctor.
But anyway, in
after
regards
the meeting.
To him showing the area there, he's right. He's pretty much stuck to the plume area.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm concerned with all of these people to the west that have chrome in that area. and why conveniently the water board has allowed PG&E to have their way. They got kind of like, you get to the west, whoop, border, just like Germany. Hey, can't cross that wall. There's no Chrome 6 over there, Blom. That's crap, and you know it. When high water tables and 50 years of this, even before we were, you know, that whole area, the flood area, whatever. Whatever you had, water coming heavy down the Mojave River, the rushing through there. Now it disturbs stuff. And even the heavy stuff on the bottom is going to get picked up. So it's got to go somewhere. It'll go all the way to the end. Now when you got a contamination or a heavy metal and it goes to the end, a lot of it will drop before it comes back. Now you got all them people to the west. They have that situation. And I realize that PG&E wants to get out of it. They don't want to go to the west like they didn't want to go to the east. Common sense. We had a big corporation, I would too. But the thing is what I'm trying to say to you water board people is, you work for all the people in the state in the Hinkley. All of them. They all pay taxes one way or another. And they should all be treated the same as the people in the plume area. That should not. About 3 years ago, or 2 years and a half, or maybe three, I talked to a gentleman on your water board. He was a young, kind of dark-haired guy. And he said he was going to work on not having any boundaries. That was the last time I ever seen him. Okay. Why is that? I mean, he just like, oh, I can't do that. But I just think you should just take a good in-depth look at this. And looking money-wise for PG&E, and I know that, I wouldn't want to do it either. But in all fairness to the people that are paying taxes and want to have faith in you, and now don't really because they think they got chopped off like the German wall out there. And we know it's there. Dr. Zwicky knows it's there, but he has guidance.
If I could jump in on that point, I think Dr. Zwicky's study will help answer some of those questions. And with that, we're going to move on to public forum. Is there anyone that from the public that wishes to share anything with the board at this time? Yes.
Darren, I just have a couple issues that I've remembered